Radio.
How You Can Uphold Religious Freedom. A talk by Professor Greg Craven at the Sydney Archdiocesan Pentecost Consultation.
I always try to remember when I was going to give a speech in front of Cardinal Pell to begin with Your Eminence. And I was at a meeting with Bishop Comensoli all afternoon with a number of other bishops, and we were discussing what you called an apostolic delegate. So, ladies and gentlemen, your temporary significance. It's lovely. Well, not lovely, but it's okay to be with you, your significance, today. And this topic that we're talking about is really a vital topic to Australian Catholics, because the truth is that without religious freedom, Catholicism wouldn't collapse, but it'd certainly be a lot harder, as Bishop Peter suggests, to practice our faith. One of the interesting things about it is you would be very unlikely to have had this topic 10 years ago. Very unlikely we would even be worrying about this sort of thing. So what that suggests is that things have changed in the last 10 years, that things are considerably more troubling. And I think that's right, that this is a good time to talk about it, and that the fundamental point really is that for a long time, we've taken religious freedom as Catholics for granted. You know, religious freedom might be a problem for smaller groups of people, for Baha'is or for Jews or whatever, but for us, we're big and nasty and unpleasant, we can look after ourselves. Now, that idea of religious freedom is much more contested. And with that in mind, that these things change over time, I'd like to suggest to you that religious freedom really, and religion generally in Australia, has gone through three phases during our history from 1788. And it makes sense to contextualise this debate in terms of those three stages. Now, these are not precise, but I'll put them something like this. The first stage around religion and freedom of religion is what I would call the war between religions, which ran from about the foundation of European Australia in 1788 to about 1970. And what you would characterise it as would be a contest for dominance between different types of Christian religion. We don't remember terribly much, but in 1788, when Australia was founded, the Church of England was the established church. It was still against the law for a Catholic to be an officer in the army, or a judge, or a member of parliament. And that only gradually changed. It went backwards and forth. By the middle of the 19th century, you had actually got to the stage where you had toleration of Catholics. Catholics were allowed to vote, always a dangerous idea. And the government would even fund Catholic schools. And it funded Catholic schools run by lay teachers. But in the 1870s and 80s, that went back. And governments began to say, no, we don't want religious schools, we want free, compulsory, secular education. And so, in a sense, religious freedom became a little less free. There was, if you like, an anti-Catholic reaction there. And I can remember in my own childhood, I mean, things that probably most of you don't remember, where kids from state schools and Catholic schools would chant at each other. We actually chanted the same chants, which wasn't terribly inventive. It just went, you know, fill in here, Catholics, Protestant, dogs, jump like frogs, in and out the water. You would have thought we'd have our own chant. You had some very strange legislation. There was legislation in Victoria passed in the 1920s called the Unlawful Processions and Assemblies Act. You might think that's about demonstrations. What it actually said was you couldn't carry a religious image within the precincts of the Victorian Parliament. And the Victorian Parliament's precincts were defined as extending in 600 yards in any direction from the Victorian Parliament. It was designed to stop Catholic processions in those areas. Now, that was what religion and religious freedom was like for a long time, really until I was about 12 years old, starting up in the 1970s, and then you went into a second phase. Now, the second phase I would describe as being the law within religions. And it lasted from about 1970 to the early 2000s. It was a debate that you would probably all be familiar with, which in the press would be crudely characterised as the fight between the left and the right internally within Christian churches. Catholic Church, the Uniting Church, the Presbyterian Church. It was broadly an argument about whether or not churches would accommodate themselves to secular values. And in a sense, that replaced that war between religions. Churches were too busy arguing within themselves to worry about it. And the outcome of that war, for what it was worth, it was that in most Christian groups, those in favour of secular accommodation won. And you can see that the Anglican Communion, the Uniting Church Communion, those types of communions have tended to go in that direction. It didn't happen in the Catholic Church, which you would expect. In the Catholic Church, there was, in a sense, a triumph of what you might call the classical position. Now, one of the interesting results of that, of course, is the Catholic Church is in an interesting state. It's possibly the last of the mainstream, of course there are many other, but the last of the really big traditional Christian religions. And now we've moved into third stage. We had the war between religions, the war within religions, and now we have the war on religion. And this is characteristically different. It's not an argument about which religion is better or what type of religion is better, but that all religions are bad. It's sometimes described as secularism. It's not. It's not simply secularism in the sense that it promotes secularism. It's positively anti-religious. And it is particularly anti-Catholic. Why? Because in traditional Christian terms, in many ways, the Catholic Church is the last man, or if you like, the last big man left standing. And if you can take out the Catholic Church, you can take out anything. Now, in saying that, we're obviously at an absolutely critical point. I'm not counselling despair, because one of the things I've been saying to you is there've always been threats to freedom of religion through all those periods. But what I am saying is we are now in a characteristically different situation. We're actually facing a general attack. And I agree with what Peter says about the symptoms of that attack in terms of things like the media. Now, what I'd like to do is to just park this thought in your minds while I go through a couple of various legal things. And that's this, that although as a lawyer, I like to believe that everything ultimately rests upon the law, and you might recall that our Lord was occasionally troubled by lawyers who had a similar view. Ultimately, the freedom of religion does not depend on law or lawyers or anything lawyers or laws do. It depends on two things. One is on a society valuing religion as a good thing. If there is not that social consensus, you can have any law you like. Religion will not be free. It's a fundamental fact. And the second is the political capacity based upon that fact, and I say political again, the political capacity based upon that fundamental fact to resist attacks on religion. Those are the only two things that ultimately guarantee freedom of religion. And we have to worry about these attacks. There are numerous substantive and cultural attacks on freedom of religion in Australia today. To give you the example of only the worst of these, you have a law called the Abortion Law Reform Act in Victoria, which requires a medical practitioner who has a conscientious objection against performing an abortion, by law and subject to legal penalty, to refer a woman to a practitioner whom he or she knows will perform an abortion. In other words, if you will not perform an abortion, you will be morally conscripted, subject to criminal punishment if necessary, to take part in the process of securing that abortion. That's a fundamental example of a breach of freedom of religion. But at the same time, all around us, we see a media climate that is deeply hostile to notions of religion. Religion is almost funny. If it's not funny, it's dangerous. And of course, one of the great vulnerabilities here is, of course, always to young people. As someone who's taught in universities now for almost longer than I care to remember, for 32 years I've taught in universities, one thing I've learnt is this. Young people can survive almost anything. They can survive persecution. They can survive being put in jail. They can survive just about anything you can throw. But make them look daggy. Make them look stupid. Make them embarrassed to be religious,
And that's the way that I would go. And every time you watch certain programs on certain television stations and read certain newspapers, you're going to feel pretty dumb if you are religious. You'll feel particularly dumb if you're a Catholic. And above all, you'll feel really stupid if you barrack for South Sydney, but that's a different topic. Now, in terms of existing protections for freedom of religion, there are some protections in Australia. Probably the most prominent is contained in the Australian Constitution, section 116. And that is based on an equivalent clause in the American Constitution, but without a lot of problems that that clause has given. And among other things, it guarantees the free exercise of religion. Now, funnily enough, the only reason section 116 is in there is because we have another provision called the preamble, which contains a reference in the Constitution to humbly relying on the blessing of Almighty God. And when that was put in there, and that was put in there at the insistence of a number of absolutely ferocious, terrifying feminist teetotaler groups, which wanted, they were very Protestant teetotaler, they wanted a reference to God in the Constitution. A number of other people who liked to drink and didn't like God so much said, well, we better have something saying that you can't impose religion. So there is a clause in the Constitution which says people are entitled to the free exercise of religion. And that to some extent gives a constitutional protection. It means if you passed a law saying no one is allowed to be a Catholic, that would be invalid. Understand, though, it's not an absolute freedom. The way the High Court interprets it, it says, is, well, it doesn't mean you can never burden the exercise of religion. It means that you can't burden it unless you're doing it for a legitimate end, and the burden you place on it is no more than necessary to protect that end. Give you an example. There's a famous case about the Jehovah's Witnesses who wanted to hand out cards saying, you must not fight for Australia in World War II. A law was passed saying they couldn't hand out the cards, and the High Court said, well, it burdens the free exercise of religion, but it's necessary for the defence of the realm. It's all right. So it's a limited freedom. Understand also, it only applies to the Commonwealth. So state parliaments legally are absolutely free to pass laws like the Victorian abortion legislation inhibiting religion. So the constitutional protection is limited. There are bits of legislation, acts of parliament, which guarantee some freedom of religion. Classically, if you look at equal opportunity legislation, which every state has, it will give some scope to freedom of religion, but typically it's not so much a guarantee of freedom of religion as it exempts you from being prosecuted if you discriminate against someone else genuinely on the basis of religion. So, for example, Catholic schools do not have to hire people who are absolutely opposed to Catholic teaching because there is an exemption, but those exemptions get narrower and narrower every year and are whittled away piece by piece. And anyway, no matter how good they are, because they're legislation, Parliament can change them. So if you get the wrong group of politicians, they are no defence at the end of the day. And then finally, there's that third type of protection that I talked to you about before, and that's the one that is fundamental. The political and social consensus that religion is worth protecting. And it's that consensus that is under siege and is becoming seriously frayed by the sort of cultural assaults that I'm talking about. Now, there is one other thing people will sometimes say protects freedom of religion, and that's the idea of fundamental human rights. We all love fundamental human rights. I remember once writing in a book that a fundamental human right was an ambit claim with good PR. Now, the idea of human rights is actually based on Christian theology. Every international human rights instrument has freedom of religion, so human rights legislation must be our friend when it comes to freedom of religion, mustn't it? Absolutely not. Because the way that human rights instruments are invariably interpreted in Western courts is that they have a hierarchy of rights. So freedom of expression and freedom from discrimination and privacy and rights to this and rights to that are right up the top. And no matter how prominently freedom of religion is contained, it is seen as an inferior right. Just as the right to bodily control allegedly involved in the Victorian abortion legislation automatically trumps the right to freedom of religion for a doctor, so it goes in Canada and in the United States and Australia whenever there is a conflict between freedom of religion and something else. In actual fact, in human rights theory, religion is typically seen as a means of abusing rights. Religion is typically seen as something to be protected against. I remember a very brilliant lawyer saying how that at a very famous Canadian law school, the staff were polled on what is the most dangerous force in the world today. And the answer was religion. And that is very much the way it goes in these types of contexts. So I suppose that the crucial question is, in this type of situation, what should one do? You know, how would you make freedom of religion stronger in Australia? Well, there are a number of things you could do, but I'd like to suggest most of them have real difficulties. One of the most appealing way, one way, would be to say, right, you know, we're going to go into the Constitution and we're going to get that weak, you know, wussy sort of apostolic administrator of a section 116, and we're going to put in a great big cardinal-type provision. Problem is, to do that, you'd have to have a referendum. And you'd have to have it passed in six states and by a majority. And hands up, who thinks a clause proposing a stronger freedom of religion would actually get up at a referendum? The truth is, nothing gets up at a referendum. I know that because I was on the team that tried to get an Australian republic. So that's not going to work. Well, a second thing you could do, you could try and fix up each statute, each equal opportunity statute. You could try and repeal the abortion law in Victoria. And that would be a very good idea. But of course, to do that, you're going to have to command each parliament. And you're going to have to keep commanding each parliament to make sure you fix each problem. Not saying you shouldn't do it, but it's going to be an ongoing fight and it's going to depend on something else. I'll come back to that. The final thing you could do, and this is sometimes suggested and is worth thinking about, well, maybe we need comprehensive freedom of religion legislation. Maybe we need a Freedom of Religion Act, which overrides every other act and guarantees freedom of religion. But there are two problems, one practical, one conceptual. Practically, who would you get to pass this act? Conceptually, once you've decided that it's up to Parliament to decide what freedom of religion is, you have conceded the game that in the future, Parliament may narrow that whenever it likes. So where does that leave you? Well, it seems to me it leaves you right back at the start, that the only fundamental guarantee of freedom of religion in Australia is political and social. The maintenance and the fighting for the political and social consensus that says religion is worth protecting and should be protected. And the real question then is not what laws you can pass, but what you have to do to vindicate that consensus. And it seems to me it involves a series of things. One is, it involves a willingness to speak out. It's very, very frightening to be unfashionable. I remember having to address the Doctors for Conscience in Victoria. These guys are actually fighting against this legislation. And I actually felt a twinge of fear as I stood up to be tape recorded to do this stuff. And I'm reasonably invulnerable in many ways, but you know, if I can feel, you know, nervous, I don't see why you shouldn't. I think there has to be a willingness to use such power as you have. The number of politicians who have said to me, it's so good that Catholics can't count, that you can't work out how many of you there are, what percentage of the electorate you are, and where you fit in particular types of electorate. Because otherwise, to use the Latin phrase he said, we'd be stuffed. You have to be prepared to organise. It's one thing to have an opinion, it's another thing to have an organised opinion that can be expressed. And when you express that opinion, it seems to me, the expression of it has to be attractive and articulate. There's no point standing up saying, you know, my name's Greg Craven, I hate you and I want to thump you and I'm in favour of freedom of religion, are you? Because the answer will be no. You know, we're at our best when we are urbane. And with that, we have to be prepared to argue on arguments based on things that go beyond our own perspective. It's one thing to say, I'm religious, I demand the freedom of religion, but you're not, so why should you be interested? For example, in relation to the abortion legislation, the very best argument would be an argument put by a person who was neither religious nor opposed to abortion, but saw this law as a fundamental attack on conscience and therefore an attack on all conscience, whether religious or not, including their own. And the last thing is that I would say this, that for all of those things, there is an extraordinary responsibility on younger people. Because at the end of the day, it's actually going to be younger people who are going to be in the positions to take these types of arguments in the long term and to maintain those arguments when people and I are long gone from that scene. And as I say, it is the younger people who are themselves most vulnerable to this type of pressure. So I see no way for this but the hard way. There is no magic bullet. There is no legal solution. There is only winning a fundamental social argument. Thank you.
That was a talk by Professor Greg Craven. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.